What you're going to hear is Dizzy Gillespie playing one of his favorites, Salt Peanuts.
Are there lyrics to this song, you think?
I don't think so.
Hold on, hold on.
The man played the trumpet. It's hard to sing when you're playing the trumpet.
You need company, like, you know, like Santana. Yeah.
Oh, maybe someone can. I bet there is someone who can actually talk while playing the trumpet at the same time.
Salt Peanuts.
You can't just throw salt peanuts in the middle of a phrase and say that you're coming up with lyrics. You're not Tim Rice.
Salt peanuts. Salt peanuts. Salt peanuts.
I'm imagining like a great musician, like an Elton John, sitting down and saying, "So, what do you have for me for lyrics?"
Is he doing it? Oh, I was right. Wow.
Okay. I can't believe I have to eat my words. The lyrics to Salt Peanuts really are just salt peanuts over and over again. That's not fair. I had a very, very good point I was making. Oh, Dizzy Gillespie, you're letting me down.
I get that he plays very well, but I don't understand the concept of Salt Peanuts.
As a lyricist, Dizzy Gillespie is not in the top tier. As a trombonist, he is, though.
Trumpeter.
Whoops. I'm not good with my brass instruments.
No.
But I should know the trombone.
You don't know your brass from a hole in the ground?
No, but I learned the word embouchure, which I probably said wrong.
Is it aperture?
No, aperture is the special thing you need to do with your mouth, little kissing.
It's like a...
Yeah, in order to actually...
I played the trumpet for briefly in the sixth grade.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh, so you're the expert. You're the Dizzy Gillespie writer.
Yes, I think I could play Let's Go Band.
How many notes did you know?
I knew that. Bum, 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 bum.
Okay.
Bum, bum, bum.
I played the oboe in fifth grade, which doesn't have an embouchure because it has a reed.
Oboe is one that's like a big long...
It looks like a clarinet, except it has a reed sticking out of it.
It's kind of an effeminate instrument, what do you say?
No. Why? No. What? Wait, what makes it effeminate?
I think of, you know, woodwind is being more effeminate. Brass is man, woodwind is a... Yeah.
I can't think of a single female oboe player.
Or male. Or male.
I can think of two male oboe players.
Who? Who?
Not counting myself. I have a friend, Nick, who is an oboe player. And John Delancey, the guy who played Q in Star Trek, his dad is a very famous oboist.
Hmm.
With the caveat that he's an oboist, so very famous and oboist. He's as famous as an oboist gets. Oh, but that reminds me of something interesting. I saw my friend Nick, like, in real time. I heard that John Delancey's dad was an oboist, so I wrote him to say, "Hey, did you know John Delancey's dad was an oboist?" And he's like, "Yeah, of course I did." There are not that many famous oboists out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, thanks to social media and like when people respond to a post, it gets moved up on your Facebook feed. I saw a conversation he and someone else were having where she brought up the same thing, and he's like, "Wow, I didn't know that. Thanks for letting me know."
Hmm.
Like. Wait, when I told you, you said you knew. But when she said it, you didn't know.
Well, yeah, he was going to shut her down.
Yeah. Yeah, so he was...
You know, you're an oboist. You got to take what you can get, man. You don't have that many groupies.
I don't think she was a groupie. I think he was just being polite. In mm-hmm. retrospect, it was just being polite. And I've heard...
There has to be, like, an oboe groupie. Like, if we're going with the idea that there's some, you know, it's like... Somebody has, like, a thing for everything.
Mm-hmm.
There are women who just, like, nonstop, like looking at oboe message boards all day long. You know, like, just trying to, like, you know, hook up with oboists. Like, that's their thing.
Now, is it just knowledge that someone can play the oboe, or do they need to be playing the oboe to be
I imagine that enticing. Somehow their feeling is that the oboe technique translates to the bedroom.
See, now there are people who are attracted to comedians and people who can make people laugh, but you need mm-hmm. to actually make someone laugh. You can't just be like a block of wood and say, "Yeah, I'm a comedian," and never actually deliver any jokes.
Well, I'm trying.
Welcome to the 1917 podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Ryan, and with me, as always, is Vinny Nardiello.
Ahoy, hoy, Jeff.
Ahoy, hoy.
I got my shirt on, too.
You did. Mm-hmm. I'm of two minds about the t-shirt, which is great, but I feel like I can never wear it on show days because, like I don't normally wear t-shirts in the evening. I'm wearing the shirt I wore all day long.
Yeah.
But then I can't wear it on any other day. It's like, well, I might as well wear it on a show day.
So I usually put a t-shirt on at night. I don't want to be my clothes from work. I like that. No matter what, I want to switch over.
That's a good idea.
Clark Kent Superman kind of thing.
It's nice now because you don't. It's not so hot that you're sweating through a shirt by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a certain point where it gets so cold that I don't need to iron clothes anywhere more because I can just get away with wearing sweaters over everything.
Speaking of sweating, your socks are doing much better this week.
Thank you. They were a bit aromatic.
They're revolting. Yeah, it was really hard to do a show out like that.
Speaking of things that smell like socks, I'm going to bring in our sponsor this week. Our sponsor this week is Johnston's Liquid Beef. I'm sorry, Johnston's Fluid Beef. I didn't want to set you off the wrong way.
Yeah, the word liquid wasn't invented yet.
No.
I think they said fluid in its place.
No, 100 years ago today, fluid beef was all the rage. Mm-hmm. Here's a brief advertisement from the time. Professor J.M. Bigelow gives an endorsement. Professor J.M. Bigelow of Albany Medical College says, Johnston's Fluid Beef is a success. Infants and little children thrive on it and will take and retain it on an irritable stomach when milk and prepared foods are rejected. In feverish and convalescences, it is peculiarly grateful and nourishing and always well-born, never ejected by the stomach. It is exceedingly nutritious and in price within reach of very moderate means.
I think anybody gets to just call themselves professor. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
like doctor, you assume there's some sort of...
Right.
Doctor, you know, like degree involved.
Right. And in like old English, like Oxford and Cambridge, professor meant the one teacher at the college that was the most heightened and elevated. But now anyone who's teaching like introduction to philosophy for 3 credits and is making $1,800 a year gets to call themselves a professor.
Yeah. So this guy, do you think he's actually a professor?
I think he is a real teacher at Albany Medical College, but he could be teaching, like, janitorial services. Maybe they have multiple things going on.
Is it like the way Dr. Phil's not really a doctor?
Well, I think he is a doctor, but he's not a medical doctor, right? I think it's Dr. Ruth is a sociologist.
Mm-hmm.
I met her one time.
Yeah.
Very short, like 4'10". But
really?
Yeah.
I know. Is that her gimmick?
Her gimmick is that she's short?
Yeah, she's like a short little...
Little German lady?
Little German, yeah.
Yeah.
Like a tiny Gestapo. That's her gimmick.
I'm rereading Professor Bigelow's claims, and the health claims are, one, you're not going to throw up after you eat it, which is...
Unlike real beef.
Yeah. Two, it's cheap. And three, exceedingly nutritious.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what liquid or fluid beef is?
No.
It's been described as beef tea. So imagine like beef bouillon.
Like a beef broth kind of?
Kind of, except you take beef broth and you like boil it and you reduce it down until it's basically like the consistency of mayonnaise.
Mm-hmm.
And then you squeeze that into a bottle. And then the bottle is vacuum sealed. So you put it on the shelf and it just never expires.
Can you still buy?
Yes, you can.
Should we put an order in and get some for the next show?
I don't want to order it because it sounds disgusting.
All right, we'll order it. We'll have some liquid beef and a cigar.
And a cigar. There's so much other 1917 food we could have. Vichyssoise, the famous cold leek and potato soup, is originated in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about getting some Vichyssoise, but they don't sell it.
Well, we have to make it.
You have to.
Can we just take regular potato soup and like put it in the fridge?
I think you can. That was the origin. I was reading up on Vichyssoise, and the origin was someone had made like a hot potato soup, potato and leek soup, but it was so hot they needed to cool it down, so they poured cream in it. But they poured so much cream and it got cold, not just not hot, and it tasted good even though it was cold. So that became a famous thing served in the finest London salons. starting in 1917. But I didn't make that. And I don't want to buy a can of Campbell's potato soup and then pour cold milk in it and say, here, here's vichyssoise.
No, I think we should order some fluid beef.
Okay. I'll order some Bovril for us. But my brother, Sean, told me about fluid beef because he's reading a book about Winston Churchill. And Churchill was fighting in World War I at this time, and he was in South Africa. And they apparently had a bunch of fluid beef left over from the Boer War of, like, 1889 or something.
And it's still good.
And it was still good because this was before the age of expiration dates. So they're like, oh, there's no expiration date. We also didn't invent the concept yet. So,
yeah, so therefore everything's good.
Yeah, therefore eat it. And because it's proven to not make you throw up, then, you know, if you're holding it down, it can't be that
bad. And we know for a fact that Churchill lived through this.
And he's a stout guy, so he must have been taking nutrition from somewhere. Maybe that was his secret.
Picture Winston Churchill in your head right now.
I always do.
All right, so I'm picturing him right now. I'll be honest with you, I can't... Whenever I picture Winston Churchill, I realize I'm actually picturing W.C. Fields.
I'm picturing a variety of actors who have played him over the years.
Yeah.
If you're like a fat bald guy, you need to play Churchill at some point.
That's what's popping in my head, though. I'm like, no, I know you're W.C. Fields. I know you're not Churchill, but for some reason, like there when I'm picturing the Treaty of Versailles being signed and W.C. Fields there.
I have a picture of Albert Finney in a movie called The Gathering Storm, which was only rated PG-13, but there's a scene where he gets up and he's naked in the bathtub.
He's playing Churchill?
He's playing Churchill, and it's clear he's not wearing a fat suit, and very briefly you see his balls. Like, this is not what I wanted from a Churchill biopic.
Well, I think there's been so many Churchill depictions. I imagine that, like, we have to... All right, what's going to set it apart?
We're going to show you his balls.
Churchill's balls.
A lot of stuff happened this week in 1917. On October 22nd, Mata Hari was...
Her again?
...was killed. Yes. Wow. This is the end of her story. She was shot. This is also where one of the Portuguese Fatima visions was actually... like, witnessed, the one we talked about a couple of months ago.
No, it was so long ago, actually, I kind of don't remember what happened. You could have introduced that story to me, and I would not know we already did it.
There's one more callback. We had talked about, the airports that opened in 1917, and one of them, Love Field, opens up on October 19th.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that served Dallas. And I'm assuming it was just there was a field, and maybe there was like a piece of road that said, okay, we'll put a fence on either side and you can land airplanes on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it took much to start.
To have an airport then, yeah.
Yeah, have an airport.
Well, how often was a plane landing? Like 2 a week maybe?
I don't think even 2 a week.
No?
Or maybe if they were landing, they were just landing anyways.
I'm envisioning people like traveling for miles because they hear a plane is coming.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna get to see this plane. You know, it's a big thing.
Yeah, would you call it a plane, or would you call it an airplane, or aeroplane?
I'm thinking aeroplane.
Aeroplane.
Yeah, because the one thing I've learned while doing this podcast is that whatever the most complicated way to pronounce something, say something, that's the choice. That's what they choose the more complicated way of doing things. That's why every ad copy has at least 4,000 words in it.
You can't ever have a bicycle. You need to have a velocipede. one more event that happened this week, and this ties in with our Nickelodeon, because I'll just bring it up a little bit early. The suffrage at Alice Paul is jailed. She's been trying to get the vote for women, and she is jailed. There was a movie made about her called Iron-Jawed Angels.
Which is not a porno.
No. Kristen Swank played her. Again, not a porno, despite the name Swank. And there's a very disturbing...
I always remember that porno magazine, Swank. That was like one of the ones they always had, like, you know, behind the counter.
Was that still around?
Yeah, I remember. The ones I still remember, like the names of I'm assuming they're, I don't know if they're around anymore, but there were Swank, Gent.
Yeah.
Yes, Gent was one of the more popular ones. And Cherry.
When in the town we had, we're growing up, there was a guy called the Dancing Cop. Mm-hmm. And there was a big intersection in the middle of town. And there was a cop who loved to put on white gloves. And he would stand in the middle of the intersection.
I've seen this guy.
Yes, you showed up on local news all the time. If it was a slow news day, just send someone out to South Orange and film the Dancing
Cop. Yeah, it was like the Dancing Cop and the squirrel on a...
the squirrel on
like water skis. Yeah.
The squirrel on water skis.
Yeah.
So... he had white gloves, and I don't know if they would turn the lights off or if his movements would supersede the lights, but he would make a very grand show of telling people where to go and this way or that way. Mm-hmm. It was right near the police station, like 3 blocks away, and it didn't need to happen. He just wanted to do it for fun, and he was the Dancing Cop. And a block away was a newsstand, and my brother saw the Dancing Cop on his break go right into the newsstand, right up to the adult magazine section, and wearing his white gloves, just start opening them up and thumbing through them. And it was like...
not leaving a print on any of them, yeah.
Oh, no, the Dancing Cop. No, Dancing Cop, no.
I imagine that, what if this is just an elaborate way so you could wear white gloves and not dog hear the dirty magazines?
You know, that every boy needs to learn that Dancing Cops have needs.
Yeah, like he got yelled at for ruining the magazine, so he's like, all right, well, what can I do? White gloves, right? Why do I need white gloves? Let's see, I'm either playing Mickey.
Or, oh, that intersection. Maybe I could dance.
All right, so then I'm going to go enroll at the Alvinelli School of Dance. Learn a few moves. Or maybe it was even bigger. Like, he actually went, joined the police academy. And he wasn't a cop yet.
This is fulfilling like 5 different fetishes for him all at the same time.
Yeah, like, all right, I'm going to go to the police academy. And simultaneously, by night, go to the Alvinelli School. Learn some moves, and then become the Dancing Cop, all so I can dog-ear that copy of Gent Magazine.
I was thinking of like, dual fetishes, because last week, my daughter has a bunch of mermaid toys for the bath. She doesn't really use them anymore, and they've gotten kind of abused. And one of them is, like, Ariel and all of her sisters. Mm-hmm. And so I picked one of them up, and... her hair fell off. Like, it was just a piece of plastic. The entire thing fell off. And I'm looking at a bald mermaid thinking, this may be someone's fetish. I bet, I'm not going to do this, and I don't recommend you do it. I bet if you Googled bald mermaid, you'd find a treasure trove. And there's some guy right now talking to his girlfriend saying, so, I had this idea. And she's like, no, I'm up for it. I'm up for whatever it is. Like, okay. So I need you to shave your head and put on a mermaid tail. Wait, where are you going?
I'm very thankful that I don't have any kind of weird fetish. Because I just imagine it's so hard to find somebody that specific to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would be even worse in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was before people even understood, like, the most basic aspects of sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's weird because everybody had like 15 kids.
So yeah. they understood the basic procreation of it.
Yes, but they didn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't done for pleasure until at least 1958.
Right. Yeah, 15 kids meant like you've had sex 15 times.
Maybe
about 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so the movie Iron Jawed Angels features Hilary Swank. And once she gets arrested, she goes on a hunger strike. And she holds out for a couple of weeks. And the way they broke the hunger strike, nowadays they give you a feeding tube or an IV or mm-hmm. something. But back then, they propped open her throat and they held open her mouth with these, like, vice jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And they whipped an egg and poured it raw down her throat.
Mm-hmm.
It looked... horrible. It looked fully like torture instead of like feeding someone, but it was their way of saying you're no longer under a hunger strike. You don't have any power even when you're in jail. Margot Martindale is in that movie too. I love Margot Martindale.
Yes. Yeah. She's a treasure.
Yeah. She's like the female John Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if she and John Goodman have ever been in a movie,
But Goodman's he's a much bigger star than Margot Martindale. Goodman can open a movie. I don't know if she can.
No, I'm not saying that she's a bigger star than he is.
She's similarly burly.
Not just burly, but she has this ability to convey great emotion and great anger and great intelligence. And you could buy that she and John Goodman would make an incredible, like, Ma and Pa Barker.
Yes.
In a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Ma Barker was really just railroaded.
Was there a Pa Barker?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard of Pa Barker.
Oh, wait, maybe I'm getting it wrong. Maybe
I know Ma Barker.
Yeah.
And Bob Barker. I know Bob.
I think I may be mixing my Barkers up. Wow.
How many Barkers are there? Well, there's Ma and there's Bob.
And then there's all the kids. But then what happened, if I'm remembering it right, was that the FBI raided this house where the kids were and, like, shot up the kids. And then I think shot the mom. They're like, we killed the mastermind behind the Barker gang. That's what we did. And then spend the next couple of years talking about how terrible Ma Barker was.
The same thing happened on DuckTales to the Beagle Boys, actually.
Oh, that's right. Did they have a mom?
And there's Ma Beagle.
Ma Beagle.
Ma Beagle and the Beagle Boys. They're violently killed in a shootout.
Also this week in 1917... on October 16th, is the birth of Arthur M. Schlesinger. He wrote two enormous books about the Kennedys.
And let me guess, you're going to tell me every little thing that happens in them.
No, I'm just going to read it, and you can decide for yourself what parts are important. He wrote a huge JFK biography called 1,000 Days, which I have not read, and he wrote a huge Robert F. Kennedy book, I forget the title of it, but I did read that book.
Mm-hmm.
It was called, like, Robert F. Kennedy's Life and Times. It was one of those books where it's, like, it's just a biography, so the character's name is the title.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel bad about not remembering the subtitle. He had a very unusual relationship with the Kennedys because he was working for another Democratic candidate. Then when that candidate lost and JFK got the nomination, he switched over to working for JFK. He was a speechwriter for both the previous guy and for JFK. He worked in the Kennedy administration just kind of like at large. He didn't have a role, which is kind of what you think of now for like senior advisors.
Yeah, very general kind of.
Yeah, you're not handling any one thing. You're just always there in the room. And after JFK died, he wrote about JFK, and then a few years later, he wrote about his brother, Robert Kennedy. But he was like a friend of the Kennedys, but he also worked for them, and he was also considered a journalist writing about them. And I'm not sure how that works.
And your friends may also, like, you know, taking notes the entire time about them?
Yeah. Because are you a friend who wants to write about them, or are you a reporter who considers all your sources friends? Because I feel like you need to pick one or the other. If you're going to be a good reporter, you can't, at a certain point, these are your subjects, not your friends. You can be friendly with them and, you know, not overtly mean, but I don't know if it's that good.
I'm guessing it's a conversation they were going to have. Like, they planned it for the day after the assassination.
Yeah, and then it's like,
it just never came up then.
Well, now I guess I'll just write all the good things about him and leave out all the bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe they do put bad things in. I don't know.
You know, you never read it.
No. So I read the RFK book, and he had like 11 kids because he was from that 1917 generation. So we had sex 15 times, and there were 11 kids from it.
Mm-hmm.
We started the podcast off playing a bunch of music from Dizzy Gillespie. I'm going to give you... I should come up with a name for these things where I write a quiz that's also like telling people about the guy's life story, and the questions aren't really that super important.
It's almost November. You're really going to introduce a new segment now?
No, I'm not introducing a segment. I'm trying to name the existing... Well, I guess you can just call it a quiz.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an informative quiz.
Yes.
Yes. So you get a little information, and then you get a Ninja Turtle question.
Okay.
Okay, so...
So I'm taking a quiz right now.
You're taking the quiz. James Dizzy Gillespie. He grew up the son of a band leader. He learned how to play the piano, he learned how to play the trumpet, and he learned how to play the trombone. Which one did he stick with to become his instrument?
We already talked about this.
Yes. I wrote this quiz before we introduced it, but I want to see if you still remember.
Trumpet.
Trumpet. Yes, yeah, okay. Well, see, I got it wrong.
You said trumpet.
Remember, I was looking right at the YouTube of mm-hmm. him playing the world's most famous trumpet, and I said trombone.
Mm-hmm. Trombone seems like a weird instrument to want to learn how to play, because, like, how much can you do on it? Just a lot of, like, hold that tiger. Like, there's not, like, you know, there's no big, like, trombone song, really, right? Yeah. Like,
I did find out that there's a special trumpet that's made that has a trombone slide attached. It's called, like, a Firebird or something.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, I don't know how useful it is.
I imagine trombone purists, they're against it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember 10 years ago at work, there were two guys who were big gun fans, and they were talking about these special guns that were on sale, and neither one of them, of course, bought them, but they were talking about buying them and how safe their house would be. And one of them was called the Judge, and the Judge was a revolver that took shotgun rounds instead of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw someone on a YouTube clip trying to fire one of these things, and he basically almost lost his finger because you are taking something with like 7 to 8 times as much gunpowder as a bullet, and that means that much extra recoil.
Yeah.
So even if you're holding the gun with both hands, when you fire it, it kicks so hard back that you get hit straight in the middle of the head, and then your finger goes all over.
And you imagine something happens with the trombone trumpet combo.
Yes, that you're going to try to play this and
blow your hand off.
Right, or you're going to need 3 hands to play it. Like, you can use a trombone slide, but you can't actually play anything with it. You need a friend to work the slide. or you hook it against like a coat rack, and then you kind of go back and forth against the coat rack.
Yes.
In order to use the fly.
I'm just watching you do this.
It was good space work.
Yeah.
What was Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet famous for? Was it famous for a plunger mute? Was it famous for a bent bell attachment at the end? Or was his trombone slide added on? Was
he bent bell.
The bent bell, yes.
Which I think was an accident, right? It was an accident.
Yes.
That was a story?
That was the next question. How did he get the idea?
And he sat on it.
Someone fell on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had other choices for you, which is someone accidentally melted it, and he got sprayed in the shower and thought, ooh, 45-degree angle, that's a good idea. But no, someone fell on it. He also needed to have a specially made trombone case for his trombone, for his trumpet, because it wouldn't fit otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a whole series of these cases made. I was reading a story from Smithsonian Magazine about someone who wrote to Dizzy Gillespie asking for one of his old trumpets to put in the Smithsonian. And he wrote like 3 or 4 letters, and he wasn't expecting anything because he hadn't heard it. And then this one day a case showed up, and it was right there. So Dizzy Gillespie, I guess, like, fine, stop bothering me. have this old trumpet I'm never going to play again. And they put it in the museum, and it's still there today. Rare for musicians, Dizzy stayed married to the same woman, Lorraine, for 53 years. He met her at a jazz club. Was she a waitress there, a dancer, or a fellow musician?
Dancer.
Dancer, correct. One of Dizzy's big breaks was playing for Cab Calloway. Cab Calloway and Dizzy Gillespie didn't get along very well. During one of their practice sessions, someone threw a spitball. Cab Calloway didn't know who it was, but he unrightfully blamed Dizzy for it. How did Dizzy respond to this?
I mean, he punched him. Immediately just got up and socked Cab Calloway.
And then stabbed him in the leg.
Yeah.
And soon after that,
He stabbed Cab Calloway in the leg?
Yes.
A great dancer trying to take away his tools?
Yeah, perhaps about 12 seconds after the stabbing, I think he left the band then. Or he was told he had left the band. I guess when you stab someone, that's kind of a resignation letter.
It was there's something odd about, like, you know, hey, you threw a spitball at me. Oh, yeah? Well, stab me in the leg.
Imagine those are your two choices. Like, it's time to leave my job. Okay, I could either write a resignation letter, but, you know, I have to hook up the computer to the printer, and I have to put paper in, and I don't know. It's weird to write just, I quit. Maybe I'll just stab someone in the leg. And, mm-hmm. You know, I'll find out what happens there if I get fired instead of quit, because I'll probably get more severance and unemployment too.
Yeah, jazz musicians were known for their severance packages.
What sort of world music did Dizzy bring to American jazz? Did he bring in Latin sounds, African sounds, or Arab sounds?
Latin.
Latin, yes. He was a big proponent of the Afro-Cuban movement. He started touring the world for the State Department, playing jazz concerts all over the globe. This earned him what nickname?
His nickname wasn't Dizzy?
Well, I guess he had the nickname Dizzy before. I'm not quite sure how he got that. I don't think it has anything to do with his giant chipmunk cheeks.
I was thinking back then, Dizzy was just like a lefty, you know, just those nicknames.
Yeah. You don't need anything special for the nickname. Mm-hmm. But he did have something special, the giant cheeks.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see other people with those giant cheeks. There's plenty of people who play
trumpet, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Was he just playing differently?
Or did he already have the giant cheeks?
Oh.
And that made him a good... Like, maybe we're thinking
I
came from playing, but really, it's, you know, the other way around.
So, when he was, like, learning piano, it was like, yeah, I'm pretty good with the piano, but I've got these giant cheeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because originally his way of playing piano was he'd swallow it whole and play with his tongue.
He was nicknamed the Ambassador of Jazz.
Oh, okay.
And on one of these trips, he met a Cuban musician named Arturo Sandoval. And they made a movie out of Dizzy Gillespie trying to get Arturo Sandoval out of Cuba. Who played Dizzy Gillespie in that movie?
What year was this?
This was 1995, I think. Mid-90s.
Forest Whitaker.
No, close. Let's see. It was Andy Garcia who played Arturo Sandoval, but Charles S. Dutton played Dizzy Gillespie. Okay. Right. And it's a great fun performance. There was something that...
Did he have, like, prosthetic cheeks?
No, he didn't have prosthetic cheeks, but he wore, like, a giant dashiki the whole time,
mm-hmm.
and he was, like, going at, like, 2 a.m, banging on the door of the U.S. Embassy, and they're like, go away! He goes, don't you know who I am? I'm Dizzy Gillespie, and you're gonna open this door and let me in! And
you ever thought about wearing a dashiki?
I'm thinking about it now, and I'm thinking I'm probably not going to, because people would consider it offensive.
Yeah, I agree, but this thing, I can't say they don't look comfy.
They're basically muumuus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I remember when I was in college, like, white guys wore them.
Who other than Akeem wore a dashiki?
I'm serious. When I was in college, there were a fair amount of white dudes.
A fair amount? We went to the same college at the same time. I'm trying to remember one.
One of my roommates did. Joe Pizzillo.
He wore dashikis.
Yes, and he was a white guy, and he wore dashikis.
Now, if you were in a...
Not like the big, like, full one, but like the short one.
The shorter one.
Yeah.
Now, I understand if you're in a country where dashikis are worn, it would make more sense. You're just dressing with the local custom and wouldn't be seen as offensive. If you're in Pakistan, you can wear the shalwar kameez, and it's not considered like you're dressing... You know, you're dressing unusually because you're just dressing the way a lot of people there choose mm-hmm. to dress. But there is a definite Africanness to a dashiki, which conveys I'm trying to be black.
I remember with him when he went and bought them. I remember him buying them. And
where did he go to get them?
New Hope. But okay. He was not the only, I remember other guys at the college wearing them.
I am imagining a store at New Hope that sold nothing but dashikis for well-meaning white guys.
I think the owners were white, if I'm not mistaken.
They sell like 8,000 dashikis a year, and there's 3 black guys that have gone in, and their pictures were all taken and put on the wall as proof that we have black customers.
This was the late 90s. In the late 90s, people got to, you know, white guys wore dashikis.
I want... you to make like a like we remember the 90s where just your ideas for this, like, so the big things in the 90s, men wore dashikis. There was a lot of ska music.
There was
a lot of ska music.
Yeah but I remember there being guys in those. I never saw a black guy in one. In fact, first time I saw a black guy in one, I assumed he was actually co-opting white culture. Look at that guy co-opting white college kid culture. That's just offensive.
Back to Dizzy Gillespie. What one panel cartoonist drew a cartoon with young Dizzy Gillespie blowing out birthday candles and his cheeks are like all puffed out and enormous?
Let's see. One panel cartoonist. Let's see. It's either the guy from Family Circus, and it's not.
No.
Or Gary Larson
from Gary Larson from The Far Side. Yeah. Yes. That was one of the few times that he tried to draw an actual real person. Excuse me. Instead of just his
cows.
Cows and people and scientists and all mm-hmm. that. Collectible buttons are still around for what 1964 Dizzy Gillespie joke?
Collectible buttons still around for 1964. Let's see. So 1964.
When you think about collectible buttons, what do you think of when you think of
like political buttons?
Political buttons. Yes.
Did he say I like Ike?
No, he said he was going to run for president.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And he named all these other jazz guys who were going to be like Secretary of State, Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Keeping It Real.
All but 64 wouldn't be Ike anyway.
No, but he may have still been alive then. I'm not opening my eyes on Howard. I don't know what happened in the after the 50s. But he tried to run again in 1971, and people were saying, no, you should really do it, you should really do it. But then he tapped out because he belonged to a peace-loving religion, and he felt like he couldn't even pretend to run for president and believe in this faith at the same time. What peace-loving religion was he a member of?
He's a Quaker.
No, good guess. But Nixon was a Quaker
when he
was president. Now, he was a member of the Baha'i faith, and I had to read up to find out what the Baha'i faith was because I'm never quite sure. They're basically the proponents that everyone's on a level playing board. Everyone has a little piece of the truth, although all the religions are kind of basically true. But you just need to follow basic tenets of being good and moral, and then you're good with all the religions.
And it's kind of Unitarian almost.
It's a lot like Unitarian. It's like Eastern Unitarianism.
Are you still Unitarian?
No, there's not really a Unitarian religion. There's a Unitarian church.
You got married in a Unitarian church.
Yes, because I grew up Catholic and my wife grew up Jewish. That is exclusively who is in the Unitarian
church. Did you go to any Unitarian services?
We went for the better part of a year. And because I had gone to church growing up, it felt very familiar. And it was nice to not wince during any sort of homilies. The last time I went to actual Catholic church, the homily was about like a 54-year-old woman who had been pregnant with her 9th or 10th child and died during childbirth. And the message of the homily was, that woman is in heaven. None of you will ever get to heaven because you have not died during childbirth because you refuse to have an abortion.
All right, hold on a second. I grew up Catholic as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything even approaching that kind of message.
Well, that's the thing. Where I was it was becoming a very conservative place, and there were fewer and fewer people coming to church every year. And in order to keep the few people there, the homily needed to become a lot more fire and brimstone than we ever had growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always tell people, growing up, I don't remember in any church service. I never heard gays mentioned one time. I never heard abortion mentioned one time.
Same. And yeah. I grew up all over. I've been to churches in Massachusetts and Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and here in New Jersey, and nothing remotely like quote unquote like social or political was brought up. It was all parables about. Do you remember the spider web parable?
No.
It was like there was a sinner who had been evil his whole life, and like there was one time in his life he chose not to be evil. There was a spider, and he decided not to step on it. And that was the one time he didn't sin. Mm-hmm. And then while he was down in the pits of hell, a spider web was dropped down, and he was able to hold on to it. And Jesus was on the other end pulling him up.
Wow.
This may have also been an issue of Web of Spider-Man. I could be mixing them up. but that was, it was a real parable. maybe not a real parable from the Bible, maybe a real parable from
made up by a priest.
Made up by a priest in 1973,
mm-hmm.
Illustrated by someone who does Spider-Man comics. Yeah. But it was something I was told growing up. The last Dizzy Gillespie question. Those big cheeks were from years of practice, and possibly that he's an undiagnosed mutant and he should be joining the X-Men. What are those pouches called in rodents? The pouches that are used to hold extra food.
Oh, I don't know this.
They are called Hardarian pouches.
All right.
Which I think was just a guy named Harder was studying it, mm-hmm. and he got to name the pouches after him because no one had named them.
Well, maybe his name's Hardarian. Maybe he's like he's Armenian or something.
Oh, that could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I assume that he used an adjectival form instead of using mm-hmm. his regular name, but maybe his name is Hardarian. Yeah. But I've seen chipmunks put in like 6 or 7 times the volume of what you think their mouth would be, and it's just filling up in their cheeks. It's like it's like the competitive eating tournaments. Instead, they're just putting it all in their mouth instead mm-hmm. of in their stomach.
Yes.
I wonder, you could do that. That could be a new variant of the world's not strongest man, but like the hot dog eating contest. How much food can you hold in your mouth without swallowing it? I'm not sure how you'd be able to tell, though.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem that interesting to me, actually.
Yeah, the more I think about it, the more disgusting it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the end result would just be going, mm-hmm. over skin, and then weighing the chewed up food. And then, like, the cheating contest would be, hey, he threw up that last little bit. He kept it in his nasal cavity. And on that appetizing note, we end this week of the 1917 podcast. Join us next week when we talk about Felix the Cat. Until then, ahoy hoy.
Ahoy hoy.